I suppose most of you have heard of Zen. But before going on to explain any details about it, I want to make one thing absolutely clear. I am not a Zen Buddhist. I am not advocating Zen Buddhism. I am not trying to convert anyone to it. I have nothing to sell. I'm an entertainer. That is to say, in the same sense that when you go to a concert and you listen to someone play Mozart, he has nothing to sell except the sound of the music. He doesn't want to convert you to anything. He doesn't want you to join an organization in favor of Mozart's music as opposed to, say, Beethoven's. And I approach you in the same spirit as a musician with his piano or a violinist with his violin. I just want you to enjoy a point of view which I enjoy. Of course, the knowledge of Eastern methods and ideas in the West is not much older than 100 years. I hesitate, therefore, to predict what course they will take. It's like you thought that something out there was a flat disk and you suddenly discovered it was a ball. And your whole attitude to it has changed. And so we're only just watching the beginnings of these influences.
We need to take a clear and critical look at the common sense and nearly unconscious notions upon which Western civilization is founded. We need to ask, for example, whether the survival of human life upon Earth is the basic measure of practical value, whether there is any real meaning in the idea of progressive improvement of the human situation, and whether any actual progress results from the increasing control of ourselves and our environment. We need to take stock of the fundamental goals towards which our natural instincts are supposed to lead.
In my talk last night, I was discussing the disparity between the way in which most human beings experience their own existence and the way man's being and nature is described in the sciences. I was pointing out that in such sciences as ecology and biology, the way in which they describe human, animal, and insect behavior is in flat contradiction with the way in which most of us experience our thinking and our action and our existence. We have been brought up to experience ourselves as isolated centers of awareness and action, placed in a world that is not us, that is foreign, alien, other. Whereas, in fact, the way an ecologist describes human behavior is as an action. What you do is what the whole universe is doing at the place you call here and now. You are something the whole universe is doing in the same way that a wave is something that the whole ocean is doing. Hinduism is, in a way, saying to everybody, courage, my friends, you're it. Don't pretend you're not. Now, then Buddhism comes on top of Hinduism to make an interesting transition. In a way, a Hindu is still a believer. That is to say, he subscribes to an idea, to a theory of the universe. And this theory asserts that you yourself are it, or in Sanskrit, tat tvam asi, that thou art. The Buddhist criticizes this by saying, if you have to believe in this as a theory, you are still using a prop. And this is getting in the way of the fullest possible realization of the truth. So the Buddha taught no theory. And the Hindu, you see, has the doctrine that the Atman, which means in Sanskrit the self, yourself, the Atman, is Brahman, Nirguna Brahman, the eternal, as Tilak would say, ground of being. The Buddha denied the doctrine of the Atman. He said the nature of reality is Anatman, which means without self, Anitya, without permanence, and so long as you cling to it, dukkha, which means suffering or frustration. He did this because no amount of verbal denial or doctrinal denial will alter in any way what is reality. But all it did was to destroy the conceptions which human beings form of themselves and of the nature of reality, using those conceptions to defend themselves in one way or another against change, against impermanence, against the fact that everything is flowing away. Now, so long as in any way, economically, politically, religiously, you are trying to defend yourself against life, you're obviously still under the power of Maya. But when you give up all defenses, then you discover, not as a theory, but as a vivid and immediate experience, who you really are or what you really are. But so long as you're defending, you can't do it because you're still under the bewitchment of the terror. That if, I remember a funny story Joseph Campbell told me once. He was talking with a Hindu Swami. And the Hindu Swami was saying, oh, he said, I think that the doctrine of reincarnation is so great, that we are born again and again in this progressive thing that we develop spiritually. He said, I really think that that's I couldn't really face life without that belief. And Joseph said to him, Swami, you're talking nonsense. He said, you're supposed to be on the way to liberation, which is to be free from reincarnations. And yet you're clinging to the idea of reincarnation for your salvation. And the Swami suddenly jumped up and said, my goodness, yes, you talk just like a Hindu. You know, he suddenly jumped out of it, came off it. When I use the word mysticism, I'm referring to a kind of experience, a kind of, shall we say, state of consciousness, which seems to be as prevalent among human beings as measles. And we don't know why it happens. And although there are all sorts of techniques which claim to be able to promote it and which are more or less successful in doing so, and sometimes rather less than more, nevertheless, there is this peculiar thing that happens to people. And it's been recorded as far back in time as we have any recording at all. And that is coming over people the peculiarly convincing sensation that their ordinary sense of individuality, of personal identity, is transcended. And the individual suddenly feels an experience that actually it could be described from a number of quite different points of view. Now, today, we are living in an age which is quite peculiar, because in the world of science, there are no longer any secrets. Because the method of science requires that all scientists be in communication with each other. It was absolutely impossible to keep atomic energy a secret. In former ages, that might have been managed, because there were many secrets once upon a time. And people were not admitted to these secrets unless they were in some way tested and found capable of handling them without running amok. We live in such a dangerous age because all the secrets are out in the open and anybody can run amok with them. And that's just the situation we have to face, and that is just the situation we have to handle. It is too late to stop it, because that would be, as they say, locking the door after the horse has bolted. Now, I think that this is something of very great importance to the Western world today, because we have developed an immensely powerful technology. We have stronger means of changing the physical universe than has ever existed before. How are we going to use it? There is a Chinese proverb that if the wrong man uses the right means work in the wrong way. Let us assume that our technological knowledge is the right means. What kind of people are going to use this knowledge? Are they going to be people who hate nature and feel alienated from it? Or people who love the physical world and feel that the physical world is their own personal body? An extension, the whole physical universe, right out to the galaxies, is simply one's extended body. But you see, this whole attitude of using technology as a method of fighting the world will succeed only in destroying the world, as we are doing with absurd and uninformed and short-sighted methods of getting rid of insect pests, of forcing our fruit and tomatoes to grow, of stripping our hills of trees, and so on and so on, thinking that all this is some kind of progress when actually it is turning everything into a junk heap. It is said, you know, that Americans who are in the forefront of technological progress are materialists. Nothing is further from the truth. American culture is dedicated to the hatred of material and to its transformation into junk. The important lesson, in other words, is technology and its powers must be handled by true materialists, and true materialists are people who love material, who cherish wood and stone and wheat, and eggs, and animals, and above all, the earth, and treat it with the reverence that is due to one's own body.
This is Alan Watts speaking, and I'm this evening on my ferry boat, the host, to a fascinating party sponsored by the San Francisco Oracle, which is our new underground paper, far outer than any far out that has yet been seen. And we have here Alan Cohen, representing the paper, the Oracle. We have Allen Ginsberg, poet and rabbinic sadhu. We have Timothy Leary, about whom nothing needs to be said, and Gary Snyder, also poet, Zen monk, and old friend of many years.
We are attempting to get people to turn inside, to look within, and to turn on. And we don't care what sacrament people use. Throughout human history, the human race has used the most incredible variety of techniques for turning on. They've used flagellation and dance. They've used immobility, solitude, noise, some meditation, fasting, sacramental foods. It's well known that overstimulation, noise, and crowds is one way of flipping you out of your external mind within. On the other hand, silence and chanting, or you get a large group together and you get a kind of hypnotic effect. Sexual renunciation is one method. On the other hand, ritual use of sex, where the mates become gods and goddesses for each other, is another. Of course, throughout human history, men have used chemicals, plants, vines, roots. Wine itself was originally a sacramental method of turning people on. So we don't care what method people use. We treasure and glorify any method that can get you high, that is, can turn you on. But we also insist that no one tell us we can't use our sacrament if it seems to work for us.
Once upon a time, there was a Zen student who quoted an old Buddhist poem to his teacher, which says, "The voices of torrents are from one great tongue. The lines of the hills are the pure body of Buddha." "Isn't that right?" he said to the teacher. "It is," said the teacher, "but it's a pity to say so." It would be, of course, much better if this occasion were celebrated with no talk at all. And if I addressed you in the manner of the ancient teachers of Zen, I should hit the microphone with my fan and leave. Because if I allow you to leave here this evening under the impression that you understand something about Zen, you will have missed the point entirely. Because Zen is a way of life, a state of being, that is not possible to embrace in any concept whatsoever. So that any concepts, any ideas, any words that I shall put across to you this evening will have as their object showing you the limitations of words and of thinking. I must make it emphatic that Zen, in its essence, is not a doctrine. There's nothing you're supposed to believe in. And it's not a philosophy in our sense, that is to say, a set of ideas, an intellectual net
in which one tries to catch the fish of reality. Actually, the fish of reality is more like water. It always slips through the net, and in water, you know, when you get into it, there's nothing to hang on to. All this universe is like water. It is fluid, it is transient, it is changing. And when you're thrown into the water after being accustomed to living on the dry land, and you're not used to the idea of swimming, you try to stand on the water, you try to catch hold of it, and as a result, you drown. And the only way to survive in the water, and this refers particularly to the waters of modern philosophical confusion, where God is dead, metaphysical propositions are meaningless, and there's really nothing to hang on to, because we're all just falling apart. And the only thing to do under those circumstances is to learn how to swim. You let go, you give yourself to the water, and then you find that the water holds you up. Indeed, in a certain way, you become the water.
A person who thinks all the time has nothing to think about except thoughts. So, he loses touch with reality and lives in a world of illusions. By thoughts, I mean specifically chatter in the skull, perpetual and compulsive repetition of words, of reckoning and calculating. I'm not saying that thinking is bad. Like everything else, it's useful in moderation. A good servant, but a bad master. And all so-called civilized peoples have increasingly become crazy and self-destructive because through excessive thinking they have lost touch with reality. That's to say, we confuse signs, words, numbers, symbols, and ideas with the real world. Most of us would have rather money than tangible wealth, and a great occasion is somehow spoiled for us unless photographed, and to read about it the next day in the newspaper is oddly more fun for us than the original event.
So when a Hindu gets enlightened and he recovers from the hallucination of being a skin-encapsulated ego, and finds out that central to his own self is the eternal self of the universe, and you go up to him and say, well, how do you do all this? He says, well, just like you open and close your hand. And because we're all it. So, when this realization of the hallucination of the separate self comes about, it comes about through discovering that your alleged separate self can't do anything. It can't improve itself, either by doing something about it or by doing nothing about it. Both ways are based on illusion. Well, what happens then? You might imagine from garbled accounts of Eastern mysticism that one thereupon disappears forever into an infinite sea of faintly mauve jello. And become so lost to the world and entranced that you forget your name, address, telephone number, and function in life. And nothing of the kind happens. The state of mystical illumination, although it may in its sudden onset be accompanied by a sensation of tremendous luminescence and transparency, as you get used to it, it's just like everyday life. Here are the things that you formerly thought were separate individuals, and here is you, who you formerly thought was merely confronting these other people. Because what is altered is not the way your senses perceive. What is altered is what you think about it. Your definitions of what you see. Your evaluation of it. So when you don't cling to it, when you have no longer a hostile attitude to the world, you know the world is you. It is. I mean, let's take it from the point of view of biology. If I describe the behavior of a living organism, I cannot possibly describe that behavior without simultaneously describing the behavior of the environment. So that I discover that I don't describe organisms in environments, I describe a unified field of behavior called an organism environment. It's an awkward word. But there it is. The environment doesn't push the organism around. The organism doesn't push the environment around. They are two aspects or poles of the same process. And so you have to understand that this attitude towards nature, seeing the fundamental unity of the self which manifests it all, is not an attitude, as a missionary is apt to suppose, which denies the value of differentiation. You must understand the principle of what are called identical differences. Take a coin. The head side is a different side from the tail side, and yet the two are inseparable. Take the operation of buying and selling. Selling is a different operation from buying, but you can't buy unless somebody sells at the same time, and vice versa. This is what is meant by the underlying unity of opposites, what is called in Hinduism Advaita, or non-duality. Or when the Chinese use the word Tao to designate the way of operation of the positive and negative principles, the yang and the yin. It is not a unity that annihilates differences, but a unity which is manifested by the very differentiations that we perceive. Just as it's all polar. It's like the two poles of a magnet. Different, but yet one magnet.
The height of Buddhism, or the height of Zen, is to be perfectly ordinary. I've still missed the point. Like the atheist has missed the point. But for this reason, then, there is an element in the art, the painting, the poetry, etc., which has been inspired by this kind of Buddhism. This kind of art where the subject matter is non-religious. Nevertheless, there is something about the way in which this non-religious subject matter is handled that stops you. And you know there's something strange about it. This is how I first became interested in Oriental philosophy and all that kind of thing. I had an absolute fascination for Chinese and Japanese painting, the secular painting, the landscapes, the treatment of flowers and grasses and bamboos. There was something about it that struck me as astonishing, even though the subject matter was extremely ordinary. And I just, as a child practically, I had to find out what was the strange element in those bamboos and those grasses. I was being, of course, taught by those painters to see grass. But there was something in there that one could never pin down, never put your finger on. And that was this thing that I will call the religion of no religion. My mother taught physical education at a school in England, which was specially designed for the daughters of missionaries to China. When the missionaries went on their way to China, and most of them were Baptists, they left their daughters at the school, and often they gave presents of objects of Chinese art, embroidery, pottery, and so on, to the mistresses of the school. And my mother, therefore, inherited a rather large quantity of very beautiful Chinese objects. And so from my earliest infancy, I was surrounded by these things. Now, it so came about that when I was about 10 to 11 years old, I began to read thriller or mystery stories written by such people as Edgar Wallace and Sax Rohmer, about sinister Chinese villains. You remember Dr. Fu Manchu? And there were all sorts of others like that. Very, very strange, exotic figures who kept knives in their sleeves, who had ivory boxes full of the strangest poisons, who could practice the most exquisitely horrible tortures, but at the same time who had a kind of urbanity, a kind of culture that was never crude, always perfect manners. And whereas other children at that time of life wanted, when they grew up, to become engineers driving trains, or test pilots, or sports car champions, or whatever it was, I wanted to become a Chinese villain. And so, just as every child at that time of life decorates their room with the things they're interested in, I did the same thing, and I acquired from my mother's collection and from antique shops and all sorts of places Chinese and Japanese bric-a-brac to decorate my room. And so in this way, I became fascinated with the forms and the feeling of Chinese and Japanese art. And I still can't quite explain what it is. My mother, when she looked at certain kinds of flowers that were very beautiful, she said, it makes you feel jazzy inside. It hits you right here. So in the same way, when I looked at landscapes done in painting or in lacquer or on ceramics from China or Japan, I got a funny feeling inside here. There was a certain quality, a certain atmosphere of unbelievable beauty. And I couldn't explain it then, and I can't explain it now. But it caught me.